Hello, this is Hindsight and I'm Lorena Allam. Raoul Wallenberg was the Swedish diplomat based in Hungary during the war who saved the lives of around 100,000 Jewish people by smuggling them to safety. Wallenberg was groomed to be the star of a Swedish financial empire, but his life took a series of very different turns and it ended inside a Russian prison. In today's program, we meet his sister and some of the Australians he personally saved. It's written and presented by Australian-based Swedish journalist Johan Gabrielsson.
We used to run there as children. There were steep hills, rocky outcrops that led down to the water. The area was called Kapstad. My mother had warned me that the place was dangerous. One slip and you could easily fall down from the cliffs. In the woods were the remains of a house. Half of the foundations were still there and a small piece of the fence. One day when we were playing, an elderly couple stood looking at the remains of the house. They were silent. The man was wearing a yarmulke, a small hat worn by practicing Jews. Raoul Wallenberg's sister Nina Lagergren receives me in her apartment in a fashionable part of Stockholm. The rooms are filled with photographs, paintings and books of her brother Raoul. Nina is well over 90. Her daughter has warned me she's frail, but Nina can't refuse a request to talk about her brother. She shows me an old leather-bound photo album. The first image is of the house in Kapstad.
Det är Kapstad.
Oj.
Som är så du har varit där.
Flera gånger springer där på dagarna.
Jaha.
This is the house. Raoul was born in Kapstad. He used to run in the woods. You know how dangerous it is to run there. In this photo, he was only 3, and his mother was only 20, a young widow. He was often left on his own to roam along the beach.
Peter Forrester is the son of a Hungarian Jew that Raoul Wallenberg saved. Peter lives in Australia.
I mean, I was absolutely taken by the story. I was just amazed at the concept of anybody, let alone Raoul Wallenberg, but anybody who was not of the same religion, who was not of the same race, who had no motivation other than pure decency and morality and goodness to put his own life at risk to save the life of my father. And I found this story absolutely captivating. And then on top of that, to find out then that Raoul's fate had been so tragic. I was very, very moved by the entire episode.
When I grew up in the 70s and the 80s in Sweden, we learned nothing about Raoul Wallenberg in school. The Stockholm City Museum is having an exhibition about Raoul Wallenberg. There is an audio soundtrack from war-torn Budapest and a replica of Wallenberg's office. One of the speakers at the event is Per Westerberg, representing the Swedish government.
I spoke to a group of university students. They were about 25 young people, and you know, they were well educated. And I asked them, which Swede do you think has got the most streets, park, monuments after him or her? And they had good suggestions like Carl Linnaeus and Hammarskjöld and Nobel and so on. But none of them mentioned Raoul Wallenberg. And I think that's quite telling.
I returned to Kapstad, to the house where Raoul Wallenberg was born. It changed since I was a kid. The grass is cut. There's a plaque with his name. And there is a suitcase made of bronze with the initials RW. It is a replica of the suitcase that he used to carry the Swedish protective passports that saved thousands of Jews in Hungary.
Och vem är det där då? Är det,
det är lilla Raoul.
Det är lilla Raoul som tar sand.
Och det är Raoul och det är Raoul och det är mamma.
Here's a photo of Raoul and my mother. He loved absurd humor.
Absurda skämt.
He could turn anything into something comical. In high school, most students took Latin, but he took Russian. Fairly quickly, he learned to speak Russian like a real Russian. You almost thought he was Russian. He was a wonderful actor. In all kinds of different situations, he could become a different character. He was so much fun.
Raoul's mother Mai was pregnant when her husband Oscar died of cancer. Raoul was born without a father. It was his grandfather, Gustav Wallenberg, who became the surrogate father for the young boy. He was the Swedish ambassador to Japan. But through letters, he guided his grandson in Sweden. And for Gustav, the future was in America.
Try to comprehend the American character, where men grow up strong, trusting in themselves, believing that they are slightly better than anyone else. Perhaps that is the reason why America is so successful. It's so unlike Sweden, where everyone tries to conform.
But there were other dangers as well.
If you feel tempted by the charms of the opposite sex, don't forget that female beauty consists of more or less well-placed deposits of fat to entice us men. Study women and try to imagine what they will look like 20 years from now.
Here he is in America.
Ann Arbor.
In Ann Arbor, where he studied architecture. Like his father, he was very artistic. His dad was a great painter. Raoul had a dream of possibly staying in America and working as an architect. Here's a photo of him hitchhiking across the United States. He recited whole passages from the book 1001 Nights to the drivers so they wouldn't put him down in the middle of nowhere. They had to wait for the end of the story. He was very clever. Then one day he got a letter from his grandfather saying it was time to come home and get serious.
The world will always need great leaders, men who stand above the rest. It is their duty to show the rest of humanity the way. I don't think it's indulgent of me to say that you, Raoul, have these qualities. It's in your blood, in your soul.
The Wallenberg family are one of the most influential financial dynasties in Sweden. Since the turn of the last century, they have owned one of the largest banks in the country and controlled or own many of Sweden's most important industries. Raoul was raised by his grandfather to take his part in this empire. Inge Carlgren is one of Sweden's foremost experts on Raoul Wallenberg.
Raoul Wallenberg was not a very known person in Sweden. And he was not any person who was, you know, participating in the debate on the war and protesting against the Holocaust. But his name, his family name, was of course very well known, because he was part of a very famous Swedish business dynasty. But his part of the family was not among the rulers of that dynasty. His grandfather had been put aside at an early stage because his brother didn't think he had any business mind. So there were the part of the family to which Raoul Wallenberg belonged had a need to show themselves. You could feel a need of revenge in his grandfather, for example, in his education of Raoul Wallenberg. He wanted to educate Raoul Wallenberg to be a business star in Sweden, to take his revenge on the brothers and put him aside. That's my picture. So Raoul Wallenberg was raised in believing that he was going to be something big in life.
There is an opening in a bank in Haifa. The owner is a friend of mine. Your employment will give you an understanding of other people's cultures and traditions. And you will study firsthand the ambitions of the Jewish people as they rebuild their homeland. A very clever race indeed.
Oj, vad en stilig karl.
Ja, det är ju farfar i sin fina uniform, diplomatuniform.
Here's a photo of his grandfather in his elegant diplomatic uniform. And there's one of Raoul on his way to South Africa, where his grandfather first sent him. He was working as a salesman for a Swedish import-export business. And then he travelled to Haifa to work in a bank. But he found the work tedious.
A banker needs a certain coolness and cynicism. My uncles in the family bank are great examples of this. I think my nature is more to work for positive change instead of always having to say no to people.
According to letters between the uncles in the bank, they found young Raoul too talkative for a banker and more suitable to being a politician. But Raoul was hurt that he didn't get any job offers from the Wallenberg family. He was more or less unemployed.
I find it quite depressing to be waiting around for an offer. Are they trying to say to me that I should find a job myself? If that's the case, isn't there anything I can do while I search for suitable employment?
Then two things happened that would change his life forever. His grandfather died, and the Second World War broke out.
It was his grandfather who raised him and to be this business star. But he died before he had finalized this project, his grandfather. So there he was, Raoul Wallenberg, with all the demands, but all on his own. And he didn't succeed on his own in this business career totally. So at the time of the German occupation of Hungary, he was working in a, you could say, in a Swedish-Hungarian import-export firm in food business. Mm. So he had been going to Hungary a lot. That was why he was on the list of persons who could go to Hungary for a rescue mission, you could say.
In the end, it was still through family connections that Raoul got a job. The war made trade by sea over the Atlantic difficult, so Swedish trade with Central Europe became increasingly important. The Mellan Europeiska Handelsbolaget, or Middle European Trading Company, imported eggs and tin cans from Hungary. And since it was dangerous for the owner of the company, who was Jewish, to leave Sweden, Raoul got to travel for Europe.
The Germans are strong-willed, with big features and very active minds. But they lack empathy. They are not aware that their actions would be considered cruel by others. According to the Germans, the changes they're going through are necessary, and the suffering of individuals is small compared to the benefits the changes will bring.
In here, please, Professor.
Well, Professor of Archaeology?
Well, Captain of Murderers?
You had become a great nuisance to me, Professor. But everything comes to an end.
What particular end had you planned for me?
That was a film, Pimpernel Smith.
There was a film showing at the English Embassy in Stockholm. Raoul was invited and I decided to go with him.
Professor.
The main character, a Cambridge professor, played by Leslie Howard, is on a mission to save Jews from the Nazis. When the film was over, Raoul said, "This is what I want to do."
This is something I would like to do.
At least it will be quick.
But violent, I suppose. The new German god?
Of course we worship it. Violence means power, and power crushes opposition.
Äntligen den hemska sanningen med utrotningen av judarna i Auschwitz.
Here is Raoul Wallenberg's half-brother, Guy von Dardel, in an interview with Swedish radio.
The Western powers realized that the Nazis planned to exterminate the Jews of Europe. President Roosevelt founded the War Refugee Board to save the Jews who were still alive. They needed someone from a neutral country who could lead the operation in Hungary. Raoul was the perfect candidate. Through his business contacts, he knew many people there. The American who recruited Raoul was Ivar Olsson.
Ivar Olsson, he was the representative of the War Refugee Board in Stockholm. He was a diplomat at the American Embassy in Stockholm. But he had actually had two hats. So at the same time, he was also a representative for the OSS, the CIA at the time. But that was not known.
Per Anger was second in command at the Swedish Embassy in Hungary. He would become Raoul Wallenberg's closest colleague in their mission to save the Jews of Budapest.
It's interesting that in the middle of the war, I mean, it was 42, 43, those years, you didn't notice very much of the war in Budapest. There was the Swedish opera singers coming there to singing and the cultural exchange and the Swedish soccer team playing soccer with the Hungarians, and it was nearly a kind of a normal life at that time. And the Hungarians, as you know, they are they had this ability to take things easy, and the restaurants were open, the gypsies were playing their music, and life went on.
Peter Barta lives in Melbourne. He's one of the survivors whose family Wallenberg saved in Hungary.
I still remember as a child my parents even talking about it before the Nazi invasion, that we knew about all the things happening, particularly in Poland and to a lesser extent in Germany. People were talking about it, and I still remember very, very vividly that they were all talking about the fact that it's terrible, isn't it? But it can't happen here. It was only when the Nazis came in March 1944 that I realized that, hey, there is a danger at that stage. Yes.
Hungary was an ally of Nazi Germany. Hungarian soldiers were fighting with the Germans against Russia. But the Hungarian leader Horta was increasingly doubting a German victory and was secretly negotiating a peace deal with the Allies. The Germans felt betrayed and in March 1944 invaded Hungary and installed a puppet government.
When he arrived to Budapest the 9th of July, it was half a year before Auschwitz was closed. So the ovens in Auschwitz had been working for 2 years. And when it came to Hungary, it was the last country, you could say, where the Germans arrived to deport the whole Jewish population. In Hungary, there was, before the German arrival in March 1944, around 800,000 Jews. And when Raoul Wallenberg arrived, the 9th of July 1944, the largest deportation of the whole Second World War had already taken place. The German Nazis had, in collaboration with their Hungarian puppet government, had deported 437,000 Jews in 7 weeks. So that was at that point that Raoul Wallenberg arrived.
We were facing a new situation in Budapest when the Germans had arrived. That morning after the occupation, when I walked to the office in the morning and met every third person with a yellow star on, and all these regulations that they were not allowed to travel by train, they were not allowed, they had to live in certain houses, all this just came like upon us like that. It was a shock, of course.
July 7th, 1944. Raoul Wallenberg left Sweden for Hungary. On his way, he paid a visit to his sister Nina. It will be the last time she saw him.
At that time, my husband got a job in Swedish embassy in Berlin, and that was during the bombardment from the American and British. So we just heard from the embassy that Rove was coming to Berlin, to pass Berlin, and we didn't know anything about his action. So we went to see him at the airport, and there in the car we could talk without anybody listening. And he told us about his mission, that he had got this call from the Americans and that he was on his way to Budapest in a gay tie, because he knew what happened in Budapest. I think he was looking at it as the most important in his life. I mean, everything that had built him up as a person had gone to this point. All his empathy, all his imagination and so on, to cope for anybody else, seemingly impossible task.
They were queuing up outside our embassy and outside the Swiss and outside the other neutral embassies, pleading for help. So what could you do? Well, I invented then a kind of a certificate where I said that the holder of this paper has got a visa to Sweden. Until he will be able to travel to Sweden, he will be under the protection of the Swedish government. A completely illegal document. The Nazis, especially the Hungarian Nazis, there were many of them were illiterate and they were impressed by stamps. So we saved a couple of hundred people in doing this and in issuing these papers. And then when Raoul Wallenberg comes, then he, with his ingenuity and inventiveness and all that, he, when he saw these certificates I had issued, he said, well, this is fine, but perhaps he could make them more spectacular. And that is how this Schutzpass, protective passports, came about, in Swedish colors and the Swedish coat of arms on and all that and so on. And then how he negotiated then with the then Hungarian government and got the approval of 4,500 passports.
Well, I first come across his name in July or August 1944, when he came to Budapest. And just hearing his name, it gave a lot of encouragement to a lot of people, you know, just realizing that, hey, there is some form of a hero around the place, you know, who would save our lives. Because we knew that everything looked very grim at that particular time already. The really nasty part of deportation started to occur. And all women and children were at that stage gathered and deported. My mother was collected, and my sister as well. They were taken to what is now well known. It used to be a brick factory in Budapest, and that's where they collected all the Jewish people. At that stage, I was already hidden by our immediate next-door neighbors.
The fact that many embassies in Budapest receive the Jews, hear their cases, and register their names has encouraged the ones who are seeking help. If this could be done on a larger scale, it would give courage to 100,000 Jews who seem paralyzed by fear.
This is a photo of his office in Budapest. He's sitting here with his Hungarian aides. They were all Jewish, many of them former leaders of large Hungarian corporations. Raoul built an efficient organisation that would try to save the Jewish people on a large scale. The office was enormous. Often they worked through the night, producing the protection passes, trying to get information about Jews who were deported, making lists of the homes they could turn into Swedish protective houses, and keeping track of the people under Swedish protection.
Of course, how could you supply these houses with food and all that? That was also a big organization. We sent people out in the countryside to buy on the black market, to buy food, also with the help of American money, to supply and medicine and all that. Imagine that they lived in these houses to start with 5,000 people, and perhaps then we, in all secrecy, we increased that. So towards the end of the war, when we assessed this situation, we found that at least 20,000 people were living there in with Swedish protective passports. And we all saved, more or less. So my job was to give Wallenberg some advice and so on. And there was always discussions between him and me, how far can we go? We can certainly not give the whole population protective passports.
I went into one of these little rooms where I was not to get out from. Even during air raids, I could not go down to the cellar because other people would have recognized me. I did not know anything about my mother, or for that matter about my sister. At that stage, my mother were on that forced march to Hegyeshalom, which is on the Austro-Hungarian border. When they got to the border, Raoul Wallenberg organized other neutral countries' diplomats and some people, and I must say only some people, were brought back to Budapest from there, and fortunately my mother were amongst them.
Ja, det är ju en komplicerad historia det där. Man räddar ju inte 100,000 människor i en stad under de förhållanden som...
You don't save 100,000 people in a violent, increasingly lawless city without a well-structured organization behind you and the help of all the neutral embassies that were still operating. Spain, Portugal, Finland, the Pope's representative, and the Swiss, together with the Swedes, who were the first to try to save the Jews. Raoul's strength was that he coordinated all these different forces and that he continued to negotiate with the Nazis and the Hungarian Nazi government to respect the Swedish protective passports.
Irvin Forrester from Sydney is Jewish. During the war, he was a soldier in the Hungarian army, but after the Nazi invasion in 1944, he deserted and was hiding in a Red Cross building in Budapest.
So I went to the Red Cross, and they allowed me to stay in the basement of the building. But on the third night, the Hungarian Nazis surrounded the building, arrested everybody who was there, and they took us to the military court building in Budapest. One of my colleagues in the jail had a genuine Swedish passport in his hand. And he said to me, "Listen, try to fool them and tell them that you have also a Swedish passport." And that's how I got the idea. And following morning, they told us to sign it that we were sentenced to death for desertion from the army, which I refused to do. And I told the judge at the court that they cannot sentence me because I'm a Swedish citizen. And they said, "Where is your passport?" So they rang up the Swedish consulate in front of me and inquired whether there is a passport in my name. And I spoke to Wallenberg, who confirmed it, that yes, there is a name, Irvin Fenyu, and there is a passport ready for him to be picked up. And 2 hours later, Wallenberg came down into the jail, spoke to me. He spoke in German because certainly he couldn't speak Hungarian, and said to me, "We are going to help you and save your life."
Wallenberg telephoned me one day and said, "There is one station where I know, I've got the report that there is a train just going to leave. Could you go there and try to do something?" And I said to myself, well, why don't I try to copy him, do it as he used to do it. So I said to the German commandant, open the doors here of these cars. I'm a Swedish diplomat. And, well, he was very hesitant. Well, if you don't do that, I have to report to the German embassy if you don't open the doors here, because I suspect that there are people there who have Swedish passports. And you can't deport them. So he opened the doors, and I went in, and I said, are there any here, is there anybody here who has a Swedish protective passport? And there were only two. And then I said to them, as I learned from Raoul Wallenberg, but I recognize you over there. You were there at the office, and you got a passport, and you there, and so on. I don't understand. You must have some papers showing that you have got passports. And have you any certificate or anything about that? And then they showed me different receipts or driving licenses or whatever they had on them. Oh, I said, oh, that proves that you have got passports, all of you here. And come with me.
In October 1944, the regent of Hungary, Miklos Horthy, declared that Hungary had signed a peace deal with Russia. Many Jews thought that the war was over, and they threw away the yellow stars of David. But the next day, there was a coup, and a fascist government supported by the Nazis took over. Jews not wearing a Star of David were punished, and among them was Frank Baida, who had just turned 9.
And I remember the terrible fear, knowing that putting that back may cause our lives either to be gained or lost. And we tried to affix it with a safety pin. And, of course, we couldn't do it properly, and it wasn't done well enough to pass the test. And that really was a serious offense. And we came back, and they laughed at us. And they lined up all the women who didn't have the yellow star and said, we are going to take you. You're going to pay for this. And I said, I'm coming too, and they said, no, you're not coming. And my mother said, you're not coming, and I went because I didn't want to leave her. There was no bravery. I just didn't want to let my mother go. And I went, and we were marched with these armed people in the middle of the road about 200, 250 yards. And next to this hospital, as it happens, was a military barracks, an arsenal called the Albrecht Barracks. And there were armed guards everywhere. And they took us to a very long building with a white wall. And it was a machine gun facing that wall. And we were lined up in front of that wall. And we were standing there. And we knew that this was a terrible situation. And then one of the women suddenly fainted. And I said, what's happening? And they said, well, they're going to either shoot us here or dispose of us somewhere else. And this woman heard it, and that's why she fell. And of course, it went through the group like lightning, that this is what's happening. And at that point, I felt that we are finished, but I felt a strange moral victory of not having abandoned my mother. And then suddenly something happened. Wallenberg turned up, or civilians turned up, and they were about 10 meters from us, and I can't remember the details of faces 70 years back, but I know it was quietly done. There was no argument, there was no shouting, there was no threats, there was no punishment, recriminations, just a quiet chat. And I think he probably bribed them. Suddenly the atmosphere changed, and we were taken back to the protected house. And that's my only recollection of Wallenberg, knowing that at the extreme time of losing my life, somebody came and I stayed alive.
My workload is almost inhuman, and the situation is becoming increasingly unstable. Thugs are roaming the streets, beating and killing people at random. Day and night, we hear the cannons from the approaching Russians. It will be difficult to travel home straight after the Russians liberate Budapest. I send my kisses to all the family and many kisses to my sister Nina.
Ja, Raoul hade ju
The Russians were approaching Budapest, and Wallenberg wanted them to take over the responsibility for the Jewish people in the Swedish houses. But he also had greater plans to rebuild Hungary. At this stage, there were thousands in those houses, so he went to negotiate with the Russians. But he never returned from that journey.
For the Soviet Union during Stalin, with all this conspiracy going on, you didn't need much to be arrested. Surrounding the mission of Raoul Wallenberg was a lot of, in Soviet eyes, suspicious elements and suspicious contacts. The fact that he himself actually was in Budapest on an American mission, which was the truth. He was appointed as a temporary Swedish diplomat to be on an American mission.
So you think they thought he was a spy?
They thought he was a spy, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I was asked then what did I think about this. I said to myself, and I said to the people in the Foreign Office or the government, that I strongly believe that Raoul Wallenberg has been taken by the Soviets. I couldn't prove it, of course. And they said, no, how could you say things like that? The Soviets, they have been wonderful people, you know, they have helped the whole world to defeat the Nazis and so on.
After Raoul Wallenberg was arrested in the middle of January 1945, he was taken to the Lubyanka prison in the center of Moscow. We know that because in the beginning of the 90s, Soviet Union and Russia opened their archives to research on Raoul Wallenberg for a few years. He must have had a very tough time. Descriptions of the regular prison life in the Soviet Union at Stalin time, it's not a very encouraging read, you could say. We know that he was devastated of being arrested. We know that he was accused in the interrogations of being a spy, of being a part of a capitalist family. And they also informed him very nasty that no one in Sweden cared about him.
The Swedish ambassador to Russia, Staffan Söderblom, got a message from Joseph Stalin that the Russian leader wanted to have a meeting. Raoul, in his cell not far from the Kremlin, was unaware that his fate was about to be decided.
It was an unfortunate meeting. After exchanging pleasantries, Stalin asked Söderblom, "Is there anything you want to ask me?" And he asked Stalin if he knew about Wallenberg and how he saved Jewish people in Hungary, and that he had disappeared. Stalin wrote down Wallenberg's name in a book. "I will investigate his case," said Stalin. Then Söderblom made a big mistake. He said, "Personally, I'm convinced that Wallenberg has had some sort of accident and is no longer alive." This sent the wrong message to the Russians. Stalin interpreted this as meaning that Sweden was no longer interested in Wallenberg's case.
And I saw that the only way here, the only language the Soviets will understand would be that you speak their language, that you sort of suggest an exchange. We had spies, Russian spies in Sweden at that time, coming and going there. So as soon as they were discovered, they were sent, expelled to the Soviet Union, and we never kept any of them. So I told the Foreign Office, the Foreign Minister, that my suggestion, sir, is that we see to it that we keep some spies here now and make an exchange. And he flatly answered that the Swedish government doesn't deal with questions that way. We don't exchange people, we don't do that, and so on.
You won't mind spending a few minutes with me until our special train arrives?
I take it I have no choice.
Very little. You had become a great nuisance to me, Professor. Almost an obsession. But everything comes to an end.
What particular end had you planned for me?
Need we go into details?
A strange end for one who despises violence. At the hands of those who worship it.
I think there is a sort of consensus among researchers that he was killed in 1947. But we don't know the exact circumstances and the exact date. But what happened during that time was actually that close to every one of the international prisoners in Loblyanka was killed during a period of a couple of months, those who Stalin couldn't use for exchange. And the really bad thing was that Sweden has sent the signal that one was not interested in exchanging refugees or prisoners.
Då hade ju börjat återvända krigsfångar, tyska, ungerska, italienska av alla nationaliteter från rysk fångenskap under sin vistelse i Sovjetunionen.
Hungarian, German and Italian prisoners were returning from the war, and many of them had said that they had seen Raoul Wallenberg in the Lubyanka prison in Moscow. This made the Swedish Foreign Office put pressure on the Russians for information about Wallenberg's whereabouts. 10 years later, in 1957, the Russians said that they had found a death certificate stating that Raoul had died in a Russian prison of a sudden heart attack. The date of the letter was the 17th of July, 1947.
After the war, we didn't know what happened to him. We tried to contact the Russian people to find out whether they got him. And first they said they have no idea where he was, and they didn't even know his existence. Later we tried to contact the Russian government to let him go, but we were not lucky. And unfortunately, the Swedish government didn't do very much to try to save him. You know, they were so scared of Russia. When we approached here in Sydney, the Swedish consulate, you know what the consul told me personally? He said, do you want a third world war because of Wallenberg? That was his answer. I mean, what can I do?
Not even the Swedish government could really believe that this was the whole truth in the Raoul Wallenberg case. That's why all those rumors about him being alive afterwards grew. The rumors continued throughout the 60s and the 70s, and I think the latest we heard of those kind of witnesses was someone in the end of the 70s claiming that he had seen him alive as late as 1978. And then you start to get into fantasies. And it's quite a tragic row of liars and crazy people throughout those years who have contacted the family of Raoul Wallenberg, claiming that they have proof that he has been alive in this and that prison or in this and that mental hospital. But no one has actually been telling the truth as far as we know today.
I think that my mother, she realized the struggle to find out what had happened to him was going to start, which was a long battle until both my parents' death.
How did that affect their lives and your family's life, that he never came back?
Completely. Completely. Every day, one can say.
Every day?
Yeah. Mm.
Jag märkte nog efter att de på 35 år, inte sedan mellan 57 och...
And then after 35 years, the Russians suddenly contacted us, saying that in the same building where they'd found the death certificate, they also found a bag with Raoul's diplomatic passport, his address book, a calendar, and money in different currencies. They invited me, my sister Nina, and Per Unger to Moscow to hand over the items.
Ja, det kändes naturligtvis väldigt...
I felt at the handover that Raoul was there with us, but I also felt that we have to continue searching for a definite answer to what happened.
When we arrived to Australia with my wife Marion, we decided not to talk about this subject. Even when our two sons were born, we decided not to mention anything to them. We didn't want to have them a bad feeling that the parents went through something that they didn't. But then there was a meeting here, and Per Enger, who was the Swedish ambassador to Australia, made a lecture about Wallenberg. And I went to that lecture, and when he started to mention Schutzpass, I took it out to him and showed him. He got quite a shock. But from then on, when I met Per Enger, that's when we started the whole business.
Irvin Forrester established the Wallenberg Committee in Sydney to keep the memory of Raoul Wallenberg alive. They lobbied the Australian government to have him recognised as an honorary Australian citizen, which happened earlier this year. Now his son Peter is also working for the committee.
I don't think that the memories and the history will ever leave my consciousness. And I think it's probably important that it doesn't. Because, I mean, I have a 16-year-old daughter. I think it's important that she knows the history of what happened and how it affected her grandfather and how it affected me as a second-generation survivor. Their history obviously impacts on the way I think and the way I view the world. I never ignore the fact that I'm unbelievably fortunate to be in this country. That's not a thing that I ever take for granted.
I'm back in Kapstad, the place where Raoul Wallenberg was born. It's a summer's day and kids are running in the woods. I go closer to the suitcase made of bronze that stands in front of the remains of the house. I see that someone has put little rocks around the suitcase, a Jewish tradition that a person is not forgotten.
An Honourable Citizen was written and presented by Johan Gabrielsson. The sound engineer was Timothy Nicastri, and the supervising producer was Claudia Taranto. English translations were by Lars Erik Johansson, Russell Stapleton, and Michael Svanström. Thanks to all those who told their stories. Thanks also to Swedish Radio, USC Shoah Foundation, and to Jan Unger. And if you're travelling to Sweden, there's a chance that in the future you'll fly into Raoul Wallenberg International Airport. Discussions are underway to change the name from Arlanda to publicly honour Wallenberg. And if you've got a family story connected to Raoul Wallenberg, then we'd love to hear from you. Just go to our comments page at the Radio National website at abc.net.au/radionational and look for Hindsight.